Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
In what his aides billed as a major speech on the global war on terrorism, today once again vowed to stay the course in Iraq.
Some observers also claim that America would be better off by cutting our losses and leaving Iraq now. It's a dangerous illusion, refuted with a simple question. Would the United States and other free nations be more safe or less safe with Zarqawi and bin Laden in control of Iraq, its people, and its resources?
President Bush spoke to a receptive audience at the National Endowment for Democracy at a time when polls are showing that a majority of Americans disapprove of how he's handling the war in Iraq. So what else did he say? Joining us on the line, Khalaf Sepp, defense analyst, former Marine Special Forces, and professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Welcome, Khalaf.
Hello, Robin. Good to be here.
We also have Julie Mason. She covers the White House for the Houston Chronicle. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Robin.
And to you first, did you hear anything new today?
Yes, there were a couple things that were new. Of course, the White House always builds these as major speeches, which is, it's a bit of a gambit to get television to cover it live, because who would want to cover a minor speech? But there were a couple of new things. He used a lot of new, very strong, very stark rhetoric in his speech. He compared Islamic radicals to fascists, communists, and parasites. He likened them to Pol Pot, Hitler, and Stalin, which is very strong language for the president. He also mentioned that the United States and the coalition have disrupted at least 10 serious al-Qaeda terrorist plots, including three that would have been inside the United States. And, of course, these are impossible facts to verify, but it's new. It was new from the president.
Well, Khalaf, I was going to ask if, in fact, that's not going to launch a whole new set of questions. What attacks? Where?
Well, it can be fairly surmised that there are probably al-Qaeda cells in every major city in the United States. And so in disrupting three of them, it's an indicator that we're taking active measures against those that are vulnerable to our actions.
Well, Khalaf, as you know, the U.S. Top commander in Iraq, General George Casey, told Congress last week that the large U.S. military presence feeds insurgent violence. Now, the president today said no act of ours inspires the terrorists. Are you hearing conflicting messages there?
There would be in that, because General Casey has come to a very sophisticated view of the insurgency that he has to deal with. Understands this paradox that on the one hand, in a counterinsurgency, the host nation, in this case Iraq, has to win its own war, but we completely eliminated all their security forces, and so until we rebuild them, the Iraqis can't win their own war. And this is going to take time. But our presence does indeed provoke what in the Sunni provinces is referred to as the good resistance, the sense that it's morally correct to oppose the occupation.
Well, Khalaf, I want to stay with you for a second because Julie mentioned some of the hot rhetoric that the president used. What were your thoughts about the speech and the rhetoric?
Well, it would be interesting to see how the American military takes this, because on the one hand, the message is clear that their mission in Iraq and Afghanistan is extremely important, and they're up against a tough and dedicated army, and that it is going to be a long, long war. But what I didn't hear was, which is important strategically, is what is the priority? Is it global counterterrorism? Is it the war in Iraq? Is it cleaning up the action in Afghanistan, or is it as you know inside the Pentagon? Is it the Department of Defense transformation effort to prepare the military for the next decade?
Well, and you know, when he mentioned a radical Islamic empire spanning from Spain to Indonesia, that seems like a big job. Julie, why do you think this speech is happening now? You know, one might wonder, we have the elections coming up in Iraq. Do you think there is real concern on the part of the administration? They've said they expect violence, but that it might be worse than...
Well, I think part of the context, Robin, that you can't overlook is that The last poll I saw showed that only 32% of Americans now support Bush's handling of the war. He's in a lot of trouble politically. His agenda is dead. There's ethics problems in his administration. This is his the last Trump card in his deck. He has never gone wrong telling Americans to be frightened and to be scared of terrorists. It's sort of a political fallback for him. And I don't want to be too cynical about it, but it is a strategic move by the White House to remind people about the war and why they used to love the president and support him. He used to have an 89% approval rating on these issues, and he's just lost that, and they really need to get that back. Oh, and certainly they are concerned about the October 15 referendum, but I think it's more of an American political context right now for this speech.
I want to touch on one other thing before we let you both go. Julie, the president had harsh words for Syria and Iran. What are we reading between the lines there?
That the enemy is growing, and he's sort of putting everyone on notice and on footing. And the thing is that the war, he said the war on terror is going to go on until we win it, but where does it end? I don't know.
And British officials are saying Iran's Revolutionary Guard is supplying material for new, more deadly roadside bombs to insurgents in Iraq. So there is potentially, if that's true, a real concern there.
It is a tremendous concern. I've seen these mines that have been manufactured in Iran and based on designs that the Hezbollah fighting the Israelis perfected. And that technology transferred through Syria to Iran and is now coming in because there's a certain components of the of these mines that can't be manufactured readily inside Iraq, and so they're being made in Iran and shipped in.
That's retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Khalif Sepp. He's defense analyst and professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Julie Mason, in just the few seconds we have reporting for the Houston Chronicle, the president made no mention of the vote in the Republican-controlled Senate yesterday calling for clearer guidelines on what is acceptable in U.S. interrogations of detainees.
Mm-hmm.
Just in the seconds we have, how's that going to play out politically?
Well, they don't want to take a position on that. They want to keep their options open, and I think people are very unhappy with that choice by the White House.
And some see that as a real, an upstart move by the
mm-hmm.
Republicans in Congress.
For sure.
That's Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle, as we said, Khalif Sepp with us, and we always welcome you, Lieutenant Colonel. Thanks so much both to you.
Thank you.
To both of you.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Haitians are bracing for November elections, 1 year after Jean-Bertrand Aristide was driven from power, and with a history of bloody, violent elections in their past. Well, reporter Kathy Klarich was there for many of them. What began in the mid-1980s as a three-month trip to Haiti to buy crafts turned into a 20-year-long odyssey and a career as a respected journalist for the San Francisco-born American. Along the way, she was also swept off her feet by a Haitian man, literally swept off her feet by voodoo practices, and a close witness to the rises and falls of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. She also saw the ouster of Baby Doc Duvalier, the election of René Préval as president, several coups d'etats, and the murder by death squads of dozens of political leaders, rebels, and activists, one of whom was a close friend. She still covers the country for the Christian Science Monitor and other radio and TV programs, including Here and Now. Her new terrific book is called Madame Dread, A Tale of Love, Voodoo, and Civil Strife in Haiti. And Kathy joins us from her second home, Miami. She still has a home in Haiti. Welcome back, Kathy.
Thank you.
By the way, you alluded to this the last time we talked when Haiti was very much in the news. The name Madame Dread?
Madame Dread comes from a Haitian tradition of calling the wife by the first name of the husband. And at the time that I met the man that I eventually married, he had dreadlocks, and so the street kids dubbed the name Madame Dread.
But that was a little into your story. When we first meet you in the book, you are dodging mortars and bullets and wondering what the heck is going on. Others are calling it a coup d'etat, and you are completely naive. As we said, you're there to buy crafts.
I'm as green as they get when this happens. I'd been in Haiti less than 2 weeks. I was on that afternoon I'd gone out with a friend looking at some of the paintings on the streets, and we'd stopped for a fruit juice at a snack bar that was right across from the National Palace when what we didn't know at the time took place, when a coup was actually going on.
Well, whatever possessed you then, when many people were fleeing Haiti, whatever possessed you to stay, given also that you had never really been a reporter?
You know, this is one of those those life experiences when you're in some place and you have to sort of make a quick decision, and the decision was whether or not I should go home. And in some way it was my pride that didn't want me to go home because I had said I was going to be gone for 3 months. So the other option was to stay and get involved. And I have to say, in many ways, I was extremely lucky to get some good contacts. Once I got my sort of fingers wet in all of this, it was absolutely fascinating.
We want to talk more about the path that you took, but while we have you, Haiti is in the news with an election coming up. Can you just give us a thumbnail of what's happening there today?
Yeah, the only date that the electoral calendar is going to observe for sure will be February 7th, 2006, when the new president takes office. That's the 20-year anniversary of the departure of the Duvalier dictatorship. There is a presidential election, a local election, and a legislative election that's coming up sometime within the next 2 months. It's an important presidential election because the country has been without an elected president since Jean-Bertrand Aristide left the country in February of 2004.
And it's important because it's a country on the brink of failure.
I think it's been in a state of failure for quite a while now, and it's extremely important that not only do they get a legitimate government in, but that they start to get some sort of infrastructure that will allow a government to function, because right now everything is sort of off the seat of its pants. There's no money, there's corruption within the administrations, and there's a lack of credibility.
Tell us about, you know, some of the poverty that you saw.
The degree to which Haiti is poor is overwhelming. In the cities, it sort of takes your breath away. The smells, the garbage, the deterioration. Quite honestly, in the 20 years that I've been going there, I have to say if I went to Haiti now for the first time, it would be much more difficult to find the charm that captured me when I went 20 years ago.
Because it's being obliterated. You talk, when you were there 20 years ago, even though it was charming, there were children naked bathing themselves in sewage in the street. And then even years later, such big piles of garbage in the street that they'd become, 6 foot high walkways of plastic.
And that unfortunately is true even now. I just came back from Haiti about 2 weeks ago and again was just overwhelmed by the amount of garbage that is just left because there's the government isn't functioning.
And at one point, as you walk away from a meeting with Aristide, you say, Why isn't the government paying people to take away the garbage? That kind of a simple thing.
The problem is it looks like it's a simple thing, but it goes all the way up to the top where a lack of leadership and then a lack of competence, a lack of resources, sometimes a lack of goodwill, a tremendous amount of corruption, disorganization. There are so many factors that go in where as something that seems quite simple, like organizing a garbage pickup, seems monumental in a country where the government isn't really functioning.
Journalist Kathy Klarich, her new memoir chronicling her life and work in Haiti is called Madame Dread, A Tale of Love, Voodoo, and Civil Strife in Haiti. She writes that her marriage to a Haitian musician was often like U.S.-Haitian relations. It was sometimes difficult to overcome cultural differences and expectations. Well, when we come back, her exploration of those differences, including voodoo, her hopes for her half-Haitian child, and her thoughts on the activist-turned-failed president Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Kathy Klarich about her new memoir, Madame Dread, A Tale of Love, Voodoo, and Civil Strife in Haiti. Klarich spent most of the last 20 years living there, covering the country for the Christian Science Monitor and other media outlets, sometimes living right next door to members of the dreaded Tantan Makut security force, more than once stumbling across the body of a brutally murdered Haitian who dared to cross whatever regime was in power. And Kathy, you also witnessed up close the career of former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Can you tell us about the first time you met him?
I first met Jean-Bertrand Aristide in an interview that I was doing on street kids because he ran at that time a home for for boys. And we had sort of an unusual interaction. We had an interview that went fine. But then afterwards, something happened, which I to this day don't quite understand, where he then came out into the courtyard and accused me of being a CIA agent. And that sort of set the stage for a rather contentious relationship. When he ran for office, I interviewed him several times, and things definitely smoothed over, and we got sort of on an even keel. And I have to say that of all the experiences that I had in Haiti, one of the most memorable days was when he was elected as president for the first time in 1990. I'd never seen a country as transformed or excited, sort of energized. My house at the time was maybe a mile from downtown, from the actual palace area, and I had my windows open. I was giving some radio reports, and I really literally couldn't concentrate because I heard this roar, and I knew something was happening outside. So as quickly as I could, I got in the car, and I started to drive downtown, and I couldn't go very far because the streets had just become a sea of people. Everybody flooded out into the streets and were dancing and shouting and singing and taking tree branches and waving them, which is a sign of liberation. I mean, it was just the most remarkable experience I'd ever had.
One man says to you, "I can die in peace now. I've cast my ballot for democracy." But then Aristide disappointed them, and the U.S. disappointed the Haitians as well. You were also there, and again, could feel it happening on the streets when the U.S. did not come in to Haiti as many Haitians thought that it would?
There were about 21,000 U.S. troops that came in to set up the stage for Aristide to return. And they were welcomed. But what happened was they didn't make the kind of long-term commitment that was needed to really get the country back on its feet. Because when Aristide returned, he was now trying to recuperate 3 years of a setback and, 29 years before that of a dictatorship. So he had a lot working against him.
And it set the stage for the kind of violence that you see off and on in your time in Haiti. Can you talk about that, the sense of fear?
I can think of two periods which were extremely difficult. One was the 3 years when Aristide was in exile. And then I experienced fear about a year and a half ago when I went in the weeks leading up to Aristide's departure for his second term. Just to clarify for the listeners, he was in office, and then he, by constitutional decree, he couldn't run again. So there was another president, René Préval, who came in for 5 years, and then Aristide was reelected.
I just want to say, you say at one point to a friend of yours in the book, what is it about this country? Every time there's a problem, they just take over the government.
It's remarkable. I mean, the number of coups and assassinations and overthrows in its 200-year history, it's phenomenal. And we saw it again, unfortunately, a year and a half ago. Aristide seemed to have lost control of the country. It was just total chaos. There were guns everywhere. There was a complete breakdown in any sort of security system. And it eventually led to the point where there almost seemed to be no option but to have Aristide leave.
Well, leaving politics for just a moment, I want to talk about another important aspect of your life in Haiti, voodoo. You describe going to candlelit voodoo ceremonies with women in white dresses dancing with slaughtered goats, bleeding on their shoulders. And twice you describe being possessed. Can you describe that now?
This is sort of a murky memory. I mean, I describe it as best I can in the book of what actually happened to me. It helped that I had a very good friend, a British guy, who was with me when both of these possessions took place so that he could recount to me afterwards what it was that happened. But it frightened me enough that I wanted to stay away from ceremonies for a while because I was looking for an explanation.
And reading it, I mean, there's these ceremonies, and during one, your body almost like picked up and thrown around, and witnesses to that. And your husband also practiced voodoo, so it became a part of your life in some ways. I mean, he would put little keepsakes around the house, or he would ask you to do things because he had a faith.
Absolutely. And he would say that voodoo is not a religion, it's a way of life. And I think people who practice voodoo would say the same thing.
Well, give us an example of one of the things that he'd want to do, just so we know.
In our home in Port-au-Prince, he has a little area set aside that's sort of like his altar, where he's got the bottles and the offerings to the spirits and certain rituals that he practices, which are part of his daily routine.
Let's look at the future of Haiti. It's an island that's been completely deforested, a huge ecological problem in addition to the political mess. You have a half-Haitian child now. I'm sure you're wondering, what's the future of Haiti?
Well, I often worry that in his lifetime, he will not find the joy of Haiti that I found when I started to go there. As I said, I just came back a couple weeks ago, and it's unfortunately visible, the degradation of the country. Even hillsides that had some trees on them when I first started going there are now completely barren. I happened to visit the area that had been devastated by Tropical Storm Jeanne last year, where 250,000 people lost their homes and 3,000 people died. And you can still see the watermarks. You can still see the damage of the homes that haven't been rebuilt. So there is so much catching up to do that I really fear in my lifetime, and certainly in my son's, that we're not going to see some of those improvements. Mm.
Kathy Klarich, her book is Madame Dread, A Tale of Love, Voodoo, and Civil Strife in Haiti. It tells of her 20 years living there, her marriage, her family, and her news coverage. Kathy, thank you.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR in Boston. Soldiers killed in Iraq continues to climb. So does the number of dead journalists. At least 66 journalists and media workers, most of them Iraqis, have been killed by coalition forces since March 2003, and many more have been killed by insurgents. This surpasses the 63 journalists killed over 20 years of conflict in Vietnam, according to the media rights organization Reporters Without Borders. Well, last week, Reuters News Service, one of the world's leading international news organizations, wrote a letter to the Senate Armed Services Committee charging that the conduct of U.S. soldiers toward journalists in Iraq is spiraling out of control. Barry Moody is Reuters' Middle East editor. He joins us from London. Welcome.
Hello.
And in his letter, David Schlesinger, the global managing editor of Reuters, details what he calls a long parade of disturbing incidents whereby professional journalists have been killed, wrongfully detained, and/or illegally abused by U.S. forces in Iraq. Let's get something straight right at the top. Is Reuters claiming that U.S. soldiers are actually targeting journalists in Iraq?
No, we're not. We're not claiming that at all. We're just saying that for various reasons, Iraqi journalists in particular are being picked up and arrested and held without charge in greater and greater numbers. And Iraqi journalists and other journalists, for that matter, are becoming victims of the conflict, quite a few of them, unfortunately, at the hands of American troops. And what we're calling for is much greater care and attention and much better investigations into these incidents so that they can be prevented in the future.
Well, as we've said here many times, it is so dangerous in Iraq right now that Western reporters often stay within their fortified compounds, and they rely on these Iraqi reporters. Now, the military says that many insurgents, for instance, also videotape bomb scenes. They're there with cameras. So do you have sympathy for soldiers who, in the heat of, let's say, a car bomb, can't tell the difference between an Iraqi reporter for Reuters and an insurgent?
I think the problem is that this issue has been obscured, if you like, by some incorrect statements by the military which suggest that insurgents pose as journalists. This comes up again and again, and we haven't seen any evidence whatsoever. Another problem is that we pay our journalists in Iraq and everywhere else, of course, to arrive very quickly at the scene of an incident. They have their own network of informants and so on, and they get there very quickly. And unfortunately, the military sometimes sees this as an indication that they had forewarning of these incidents taking place and regards them as suspicious for that reason.
Well, in fact, Western reporters have said that the military often confuses an Iraqi's sources, you know, someone who might call and give them a tip, with an Iraqi being part of an insurgency. You know, isn't that something that all reporters do? They have sources.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And in fact, one of the most worrying things that we've found about some of our people who've recently been detained is that, as far as we can tell, because the military won't give us any information about why these people are being held, when military find photos or film involving fighting or involving insurgents on the cameras of our stringers, they take that as evidence that they are colluding with the insurgents, which clearly is not the case. You know, we pay our journalists to get to the scene quickly and to know what's going on, and to, and we pay them for this kind of film.
How does this, I mean, 66 reporters killed in Iraq, most of them Iraqis since the start of the war. How does this affect your ability to tell this story?
Well, it affects it very deeply. I mean, as you've said, the ability of Western journalists to move around Iraq is severely limited by the danger. In fact, anybody who looks like a Westerner would be pretty insane to travel on most of the roads in Iraq. And because of that, we depend entirely or very much on the ability of our Iraqi journalists to get to the scenes of incidents, to be our eyes and ears on the ground.
And do you have a suggestion for the military?
Well, I think that the many of the things we've said already, that I've mentioned already, that just because journalists arrive quickly at the scene of an incident does not mean that they are in league with insurgents.
But in the heat of the moment, you know, in the heat of the moment, is there something else? Is there a uniform? Is there some other...
Well, this has actually been debated quite a lot amongst journalists, this idea of an insignia to identify journalists in the theater, if you like. The problem with that is that identifying yourself as a journalist might protect you against the coalition side, but it wouldn't protect you against the insurgents. In fact, far from it. If you drive around in a car identified as a journalist, you may open yourself up for either kidnapping or killing. We are not asking anybody to prejudice the safety of American soldiers, but we think that there needs to be a much more open process here and proper investigations into killings, and that because our ability to report is being curtailed, the full story of what's happening in Iraq is not getting through to the American people.
Barry Moody, Reuters Middle East editor, speaking to us from London. Barry, thank you.
Okay.
We want to turn to a Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Boylan now. He's in Baghdad, a spokesperson for the military in Iraq. Lieutenant Boylan, why doesn't the U.S. military provide information to news organizations about detained Iraqi journalists?
Anyone who is detained, and we don't make a distinction between journalists or anyone else, they are detained as a potential risk to the Iraqi people, the Iraqi security forces, the government, or coalition forces.
So you're saying that journalists can't be treated any differently from other detainees in Iraq?
In the overall scheme of things, they are not at this time.
What about these accidental deaths of Iraqi journalists? Is the military taking any steps to make it easier to distinguish between Iraqi journalists and insurgents?
Well, that's extremely difficult because the insurgents and the terrorists, the foreign fighters here, have taken up their own tactics to appear to be journalists.
Well, you know, we just spoke to a Reuters spokesperson who said that that's not true, and that saying that actually makes the U.S. soldiers on the ground believe it and potentially shoot an Iraqi journalist thinking that he's an insurgent with a camera, when in fact there aren't that many insurgents who are masking themselves as journalists.
We have captured people with video cameras who were insurgents. We have their videotapes have been aired. You know, I hate to say it, but just because you have a camera on your shoulder does not make you a stringer or a bona fide journalist. Mm. But I also have to put it back on to the media organizations to ask, what kind of training are they giving their Arabic stringers on how to work in and around military operations? We have people who come racing up in vehicles, who come into very dangerous situations without understanding what's going on. And what our feeling is as well is that there's some training that needs to be done on behalf of the media organizations that are putting their people into dangerous situations.
That's a tough one, Lieutenant Colonel, because, you know, journalists, that's what they do. They race to the scene. But you're saying that that could accidentally cause their death.
It very well could. When you have a tactic by the insurgents that is suicide car bombs, and any potential car coming around the corner could be a bomber, you take everything very, very seriously.
Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Boylan, a military spokesperson based in Iraq, speaking to us from Baghdad. Lieutenant Colonel Boylan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And don't forget, still to come, what do you get when you put Aerosmith and Tracy Chapman together? A mashup from a popular DJ who's also an ethnomusicologist. You're listening to Here and Now. The baseball playoffs are in full swing, and the defending World Series champions, the Boston Red Sox, may be down to their final at-bat. In the National League, there are games in both series today. The St. Louis Cardinals hold a one-game-to-none lead over the San Diego Padres, and the Houston Astros lead the Atlanta Braves by the same margin. In the American League, the Yankees and the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim are tied at one-game win each. That series resumes in the Bronx tomorrow night, while here in Boston, the Chicago White Sox can eliminate the Red Sox with a win tomorrow afternoon. Only games Bill Littlefield joins me in the studio. Bill, for Red Sox fans, deja vu all over again. As
well, it depends on which deja and vu.
Right.
I mean, they were down 3-0 to the Yankees when they needed to get into the World Series last year. On the other hand, they were up 3-0 against the Cardinals in the World Series when they went on and won the fourth game.
Right.
So, yeah.
And there's that other bit of deja vu, which was the error last night. Poor second baseman Tony Gaffanino. He let a ball go dribble between his legs, much like another player.
Well, yeah, I suppose. I suppose it was Bill Buckner-ish in the sense that each missed a ground ball when everybody was watching, and that was very unfortunate in both instances. However, Graffanino made the error in the fifth inning. There were still four innings left for the Red Sox to A, score some runs, and B, keep the other team from scoring runs. The Red Sox managed to do neither. So they lost the game for a number of reasons, only one of which was that Tony Graffanino couldn't come up with a ground ball.
Well, and the White Sox, by the way, I mean, it's no secret. I happen to be a Red Sox fan, but those White Sox.
No!
Shocking. They're playing very well.
Well, they played extremely well through most of the season, or much of the season. Then they had a prolonged period of slump during which they blew a 15-game lead, and Cleveland almost caught them. And now they seem to have kind of remembered that they're a pretty good team, and they're playing well again, at least well enough to have a 2-0 edge on the Red Sox.
And I doubt that there's any sympathy from Red Sox fans, but they've had another sort of slump. They hadn't won a World Series since 1917.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, well, you know, maybe it's their turn. Everybody was saying at the beginning of this season, well, now the Red Sox have won a World Series. Maybe it's the Cubs' turn. Maybe they just got the wrong Chicago team in that slot.
Right. It might be the White Sox after all. That's 88 years. Boy, they bested us. Well, so then to the other teams that are out there, let's see, one that begins with a Y, I can't remember. Oh, yeah, the Yankees. A whole 5 years since they had their last World Series.
Feels like about 15 minutes, doesn't it? yeah, they have their hands full, and I think this is partly because the Angels are a pretty good team, and partly because the Yankees, like really every team in the postseason this time around, are kind of limping, kind of damaged, kind of not at full strength. So it'll be an interesting series to follow, and it's 1-1, and that gives at least some promise that 2 games hence it'll be 2-2, and we'll have a fifth game, and that's always fun.
And by the way, because of all sorts of different reasons, they're now their opponents are now called the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. Do they put that whole title?
Yes,
on hats?
I like to call them the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, north of Mexico City and south of Vancouver, just so there'll be no confusion at all.
In the National League, St. Louis Cardinals had the best record in baseball this season. I'm sure they want to erase the memory of being swept by the Red Sox last October.
Yeah, and they'll have their hands full doing it. The Cardinals, they had the best record. They started off the season magnificently well. They clinched the division title by about the 15th of June. But they've had their share of injuries as well, so they don't have the starting lineup that they used to have. They don't quite have the pitching that they used to have. And they'll have a hard road to make it to the series as well.
Anything else in the minute we have? Catch your thoughts?
Well, I love Jake Peavy's story. I mean, people talk about how unlucky the Red Sox are, but Jake Peavy, the San Diego pitcher, apparently broke his ribs celebrating San Diego's getting into the postseason, jumping up and down with excessive glee with his teammates, broke a rib, and it may be able to pitch again, but may very well be out for the entire postseason.
I have to tell you, I often wonder how more players aren't injured. You know, Big Poppy on the Red Sox, he does a sort of jump-up hug where they bash chests. If he did that to me, I'd be dead.
I think they must practice it a great deal, don't you?
Bill Littlefield, host of Only a Game, which, by the way, tune in this weekend and see that the Red Sox, yes, do it again, win 3 games in a row, maybe.
Count on it. Count on it, absolutely.
And he will always be here to fill us in. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Thank you.
you blended the music of the 60s band The Standells with former street busker Tracy Chapman, threw a little bit in of the rappers Run DMC, and added the sound of the Boston Subway in the same song. Well, Cambridge DJ Wayne Marshall has done just that. It's one of his mashups. It's called the Boston Massacre. One of the most sought-after DJs in Boston, Marshall is also an ethnomusicologist. He lectures at Brown, Harvard Extension School, and the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we should note, you've got your computer here. You do all of this mashupping on your computer, right?
Right from my laptop.
Well, we'll hear more of it, but what is an ethnomusicologist?
An ethnomusicologist is someone who looks at music in the context of culture and society.
And you went to Harvard?
I went to Harvard as an undergraduate,
yeah.
Where I studied English, in fact, and then I moved on to ethnomusicology at the University of Wisconsin.
And we just heard your Boston Massacre. Let's just review some of the elements of that.
Okay. One that I did was I took Extremes More Than Words, which is a classic middle-of-the-road ballad, really, when it comes down to it, but a very big Boston song, in fact, an inescapable song around the country at a certain point. I was able to find an a cappella.
Can we hear a little of that
sure.
first? Yeah.
It begins like this.
Saying I love you is not the words I want to
I love this song. It's an anthem.
It's not that I want you, not to say, but if you only knew.
And so I decided, what can I combine this with in the Boston soundscape that would sound good, that would have this effect of putting two disparate things together? And I tried out a bunch of things, and I ended up settling on Tracy Chapman's Fast Car.
Okay.
So Fast Car, as you may remember, mm-hmm. Goes like this. So what I did is I took that Tracy Chapman song, and I didn't find an instrumental version of it, but I did find that, you know, the first four bars or so are just her strumming the guitar, maybe some bass in there as well, which I can very easily loop using the software that I use.
Mm-hmm. You're going to have it just copy itself over and over and over again.
Yeah, I'm just going to have it run through that same, mm-hmm. you know, four-bar section. But actually, one thing I found is that Extreme Song didn't go so well with Tracy Chapman. They kind of clashed a bit. They were in different keys, really. You know, sometimes you have to tweak things a little bit. A lot of times I'm bringing things to the same tempo, but also I'm shifting keys around a bit. So what I did is I took Extreme's vocal and I pitched it up three half steps.
All right. And again, your hands on the keypad.
So they sound a little weird.
It's the Chipmunks.
A little chipmunked out, but, you know, that's also become a kind of popular hip-hop aesthetic these days. Yeah. You know, Kanye West has brought that chipmunk soul into the mainstream. And let me just show you how I can pitch things around just to show you how fluid the software makes it. This is high. This is back down. So I can keep making it lower. Or I can make it high again.
Doing all this on the computer.
Yeah, it is up and down pretty much. Right when the chorus comes in there, and I'm sorry to be teasing you about that, I'll bring in Aerosmith's Walk This Way. But just the drum break from it from the very beginning, which sounds like this. Okay?
Uh-huh.
And I've slowed that down a little bit so that it fits with these. But all right, here we go. Here's Extreme and Tracy Chapman.
More than words.
Tracy Chapman and Aerosmith together for the first time.
With Extreme.
With Extreme. And by the way, we're talking to Wayne Marshall, who's one of the most sought-after club DJs here in the Boston area. You know, hip-hop artists have been playing with records for a long time. Sampling has been going on for a long time. Research or grand theft? You know, because you are borrowing from all these artists. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, I should note that I'm not selling this music. I think that it falls under the terms of fair use in terms of illustrating certain things coming from an educational standpoint. I don't simply put these things up with no kind of frame around them. I usually do a fair amount of explication.
And by the way, I know you, obviously you're studying and researching and writing a dissertation. When you're in the clubs, do you also try to bring in the intellectual side of what you're doing or just play the music?
Well, oftentimes I do have a kind of thematic focus. I'll put together a set that I think expresses some idea or another. Some of my performances are what we might call more didactic than others. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I just like to play songs that I like together. But, for instance, there was a Hip-Hop History Day, and I did the first set, and I was representing hip-hop's Jamaican roots. I was actually talking over a lot of the tunes, but the music that I put together itself, I thought, made a certain argument. What I was going for were the songs that I thought Kool Herc, you know, the founding father of hip-hop, Jamaican immigrant to the Bronx, would have been playing had the cultural climate been right for that. You know, one of the interesting things about Jamaicanness in New York is that its meaning has really shifted over time. This is another aspect of my dissertation. But in the early 70s, Kool Herc was playing Latin funk because, as Jeff Chang's recent hip-hop history, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, says, they were throwing Jamaicans in garbage cans at that point. One of his friends came over and said, Clive, don't go outside. They're throwing Jamaicans in garbage cans. And, you know, I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I had a Jamaican classmate who every morning would come up to the bus stop and get thrown over a fence by generally his African-American peers. And it was just because he was Jamaican. So to the extent that music interacts with our ideas about sameness and difference and can challenge them is really interesting to me. I like the idea, given Boston's, I'd say, sordid history of race relations and other kinds of community relations. I like the idea of combining the sounds that get mapped on to different communities at the same time.
Huh. An intellectual view of mashups from Harvard grad Wayne Marshall, who's also working on his doctorate. He's writing a dissertation on the connection between reggae and hip-hop and is one of the most sought-after club DJs here in the Boston area. Wayne, thanks for bringing in your computer and playing for us.
My pleasure. Thanks for listening.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Len Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, Vince Fairchild, Emiko Tamagawa, Karen Miller-Metzen, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Shugarts is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Angela Kim, Jessica Gerard, and Lara Farrar. And by the way, thanks to former intern Noah Suskind, who produced our mashup story before he took off to run the world. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.